My name is Dan. Some of you I know, some of you I don't. Anyway, James asked me to give a talk tonight, and one of the things that I really have spent a fair amount of time, and I guess interest in investigating, is the relationship of language and Dharma practice. It's sort of a strong interest over the years. And tonight I thought, rather than say real formal talk about it, what I would do is just give some ideas and then just open it up at some point for discussion, if that seems like what moves to do. And also I wanted to read some from some poems, a lot of different poems, and that I thought had an interesting kind of way of talking about language and the role that language has in Dharma practice. So I'm going to just intermix ideas and opinions and thoughts with some reading some different poems that I thought were really enjoyable and really helpful. And I think also a question for me just in talking about language is, why talk about how we talk and how we think and how we use language? What relevance does that have to Dharma practice? And as you may have noted from just when your practice, your own practice, the enormous effect that thinking has, one might call it stupendous or awesome or staggering effect, hypnotic effect, magical effect that language, words, thoughts, assumptions, beliefs have just in the way that we live our lives. All the conventions that we use to understand each other, all the rules that we set up to live in an orderly way, all the things we say to ourselves that can get us so ecstatic or so depressed and down, that with a single word you can create heaven, or with a single word you can create a hell. And that, to me, is what is so important about being attentive to how we use language. How I use language, because it's a setup for suffering and it's a setup for joy. And it's a setup in the way that we live our lives for either of those, practically in every moment of life, I think. You ever notice the frequency with which you have thoughts coming through and what those thoughts are saying, and the tendency you have to believe, hold on to, have aversion to those thoughts, all of that. That speaks about the importance of investigating language. So the thing that I find particularly intriguing about the way, the different ways we use language, and this can be in the form of both thought, talking to oneself quietly, thoughts that one has, or speaking with other people in dialogue like this, is that perhaps one of the most hypnotic effects of the whole language activity is that it leads us to think that the world in which we live appears very much like the words that we use. That is, it appears in these little bite-sized chunks, or not-so-bite-sized chunks, where things are separate and unto themselves. For example, when I say, "That's a radio," everyone looks at it. Everyone says, "Yeah, right, that's the radio." You can pick it out, you can isolate it. It seems so clear what it is. Or if I say, "I'm a person," and I say, "You're a person," and we all look at each other and we all look like separate people. Somewhat. So there's this tremendous power, you might call it, or organizing ability, of words to create all kinds of distinctions, so that everything appears separate and discrete. And that can be very convenient. That's a way to create order. That's a way to make our world manageable, a way to understand each other. But I think part of what practice can lead one to after a while is to inspect this idea of things being all that separate, as our language leads us to think they are, and to investigate just how separate is everything? For example, a really simple example is, even though, for example, we're looking at each other, or you're looking at me, and you're looking at all the things here in the room, if you just notice this is an interesting way in which vision seems to work, is anything really completely separate from anything else at all in your field of vision right now? Is it? Or is everything completely juxtaposed against something else? Completely. Just without one break anywhere in the entire visual game, everything is fully contrasted against everything else. And so what we do is we say, this blew my mind when I noticed this, because I noticed that my language was setting up a category to see things separately, and yet the way things appeared was not in any way separate. Everything was defining everything else. As it is right now, everything. I am appearing against this background. The way in which I stand out is there something else here that I stand out over again. So, what is the implication of this startling insight that perhaps things are not as separate as they appear, in terms of perhaps some of the other words that we use? For example, one of the major words that I use is the word I. And I've been taught from very little and currently ongoing to think of myself as a separate I, to think of myself as being discrete. And I would say at this point that notion of thinking of myself separately, and really thinking the word I refers, just like the word radio refers, to something separate. That kind of thought is on automatic pilot at this point. I mean, it is a common assumption that I make, every day. And yet, when we're sitting here right now, or in practice, and you start to look for this I, this stable I, what do you see? Or what do you feel? Or what do you hear? Is there any one thing that appears completely separate from anything else to lead you to think there's this I that's completely isolated? It doesn't seem that way. In the same way that the visual field is completely bound up with everything is bound up with everything else, this sense of I is fully bound up with everything else. I mean, if I'm just looking down, the so-called me is completely related to the floor, it's completely related to everything else. So it's a wonderful little magic act that the language that we have does, in a sense, to, for want of a better word, persuade us or hypnotize us, or almost in the way that a magician pulls a rabbit out of a hat, puts us under a spell of thinking everything is separate, everything is very thick in meaning, that we all know what certain words refer to. So I'm not putting down that form of using language, because that's what I would call conventional use of language. That's how we orient ourselves in our world. It's useful, it's functional. But if it becomes the only way in which you relate to language, it's also a form of suffering, because you start to believe that everything is separate, and that you are just one little separate entity against, over and against, everything else. So what can you do about that? Since I think it's a pretty major situation, since most of us spend our days talking with other people, except when we're sitting quietly, and then we're talking with ourselves. Basically, enrolling each other in that game of separation, of pretending I'm here, you're there, we're all very separate. I'm talking to you, you're looking at me, the language is going on. So what have people suggested as a way to understand that game of language, and how do people speak in a different way that has an awakening effect that wakes you up from the dream of thinking separately in that way. One of the people I like a lot is Alan Watts, who has a marvelous way of talking about it. He talks about the idea that all words are basically going together. For example, you can't have light without dark. You could just only have light, but you wouldn't know what light was if there was only light. Just like you can't have love without hate. Because again, you wouldn't know what they were. So words come in polarity, and they come together. And so much of our languaging is like that. I have pain, so I want pleasure. You all notice how quickly, in a moment, your concept of pain will turn into a concept of pleasure at the slightest drop of a hat. They go together. They're complements. So what we tend to do is we take, for example, good and bad, or black and white, and instead of remembering that they come together, that they define each other in a sense, as Buddhists would say, that they're codependent with each other, we start playing the game of black versus white, of good versus bad, of me versus you, of being enslaved versus being free, and get very bound up in thinking that they're two different things. So what is example? One poet, Ryokan, what does he say about? He has a beautiful poem where he's talking about enlightenment and illusion. To start off with two simple topics. As a way to just play with the idea, he says, illusion and enlightenment, two sides of the same coin. Universals and particulars, specifics, no difference. All day I read the wordless sutra. All night, not a thought of Zen practice. And who gets his things in the willowing along the riverbank, dogs in the village, bay at the moon. Very simple. So there's a little sense of he's posing the question again, enlightenment, illusion, what are they? Both sides of the same coin. There's so many other Zen poems work on exactly that idea, and they're little statements. Here's another one. A wish to go to heaven is the very beginning of falling into hell. It's that movement, wanting heaven. Hell has got to come along. Another one. Of course, then they get more specific. Where is heaven? Very simple. It's where you're lying asleep, drunk. Where is heaven? Very simple. It's where you're lying asleep, drunk. Just that. Then I think what it starts to do, the movement that you start to see in the language, is that instead of playing and attempting to explain things with concepts, then it's just saying things. So it's moving out of this idea that words are going to be explaining something deeply meaningful, perhaps, to just expression, just expressing, just saying something, just noticing, what they might call the touchment of language. I mean, do you need to explain that poem, or is the poem enough as it is? There's some other ones that I thought were talked about this. given it up, you say? But what have you given up? Very well, you've given up the idea of giving it up. Your job itself is the sound of one hand clapping. No use using both hands. That's one. Then a reply. Had you done a good job clapping with two hands, no need then to hear the sound of one. And another one. Okay. Some say things exist. Others say not. Which view is true? It's like the difference in name, water or ice. And I'll read you another one more. One more. Wisdom, if you devise it, is false. The true wisdom is what you never know. And I think that's pointing to something else about language, that we may say a lot. We may think we understand. We may be able to explain very meticulously and very, quote, accurately or very specifically exactly what it is we do, even certainly what we do during the day at times, or even in our meditation practice. But that last poem is saying, how much do you really know? What can you really know? What can words really tell you? And that to me is a great koan, because when you think that you know from the language you use what it is that you're referring to or what it is you're understanding, then what? Have you gotten trapped in one side, in one view, in one set of words, in one way of thinking? Again, I think what they're attempting to push our understanding into is that perhaps we don't really know all that clearly what words are referring to. That maybe we just have agreement as to what we think words mean, because that's what we were taught. And that everybody, when they were growing up, somebody came in and said, could you hand me the radio? And there was this one point when you were little where you went, huh? Radio? And then someone said, you know that, radio. And oh right, radio, of course. Or maybe some of you find it's perhaps not as clear an agreement when someone says, could you please love me better? You know, what do you mean by love? You know, love, that. That, whatever that might be. And then, of course, how many people in relationships go through the struggle of thinking, well, love, let's see, is love like some kind of quantity that I have inside me? Give me more love, please. Could you kind of just open up here and take it out and hand it to me as if it were a quantity, just like perhaps could you give me more maple syrup, something like that. Or you hurt my pride, thinking pride was some kind of thing that we have inside ourselves that could get hurt. You hurt my pride or my feelings. Again, that wonderful hypnosis of language where we get enrolled in thinking that words really refer to something that's separate, solid, concrete, and substantial. There's another Chinese philosopher, Chuang Tzu, who again brings this wonderful questioning to whether words actually have a fixed meaning, whether we really understand what we're talking about. I once gave a talk like this actually in England called What Am I Talking About? And by the middle of the talk, everyone was really asking that question because it didn't make any sense. And I said, at that point, that's when I said, that's what this talk is about. That kind of confusion that, have you ever had that odd moment where, for example, you're listening or you're talking with a friend and suddenly you both look at each other and you haven't the foggy idea anymore what you're talking about, and suddenly in that moment something very whatever occurs, something very something occurs that has a intriguing kind of awakening quality to it. I had an experience like that at the 3-month course. Which I now believe I understand in some way, through that, where I was walking with a friend, and we were giving each other a personal interview at that time. We were walking quietly down the road, and we were having a talk about something that we thought we could try to understand by talking. And suddenly, we both heard something, but we had no idea what it was. It was a sound, and we looked at each other, and we were shaking, you know, like this was something we hadn't heard. And when both of us, I think when we were looking at each other, got the sense that our so-called minds were racing to find out what that was, because there was this moment, a truly startling moment, of being enraptured or bewildered delightfully and frighteningly, and not knowing what was going on. The sound, what was it? And then the intense relief as we kept walking down the road to notice that it was a brook running by the side of the road that was making the sound, that neither of us knew what that was for a moment. Wonderful experience. Freed in that moment from understanding and from being able to summarize it with language at that moment. Delightful, as I now name the experience. Again, it's sort of like, that musing. Do I really know what I'm talking about? What are we really saying? And there's a beautiful passage in Chuang Tzu where he, many passages like this, where he questions what we know through how we speak. He says, saying is not blowing breath. Saying says something. The only trouble is that what it says is never fixed. Do we really say something? Or have we never said anything? If you think it different from the twitter of fledgling birds, is there proof of that distinction? Or isn't there any proof? By what is the way hidden that there should be a genuine or a false? By what is saying darkened so that sometimes we say that's it and sometimes we say that's not it? He's really questioning. How is it that we know whatever it is we know? How is it that we come to some understanding and say anything? Because words, are they fixed? Do we agree that we all know what love is? No, we'd have to have a lot of discussions about it, and even then. Another little pushing this point even further, and you might have guessed, actually, this is kind of a fascination that I have with language, because I think it's something that we often overlook in our practice. And I've noticed, I'm bringing it up sometimes, there's a tendency I've had sometimes in practice where I've arrived at that moment, perhaps in sitting, perhaps not in sitting, just walking, whatever, where, again, it's that moment at the brook where something occurs and I don't know. And then quickly have wanted an explanation. And I think that there's something in that moment of not knowing that's wonderful and frightening. And then, once I get the explanation, then I think now I understand that experience. Whatever that might have been. So he has his little characters who talk to each other in dialogue. One of them called Gap Tooth puts a question to Wang Ni. Would you know something of which all things agreed? This is it. The response is, how would I know that? Would you know what you did not know? How would I know that? Then, does no thing know anything? How would I know that? However, let me try to say it this way. How do I know that what I call knowing is not actually ignorance? And how do I know that what I call ignorance is not actually knowing? And once again, it's just those two sides of the coin. How do you know that what you believe to be true in this way is not, from another perspective, just something else? So I think what I'll do is I wanted to just, I could keep reading these poems for a while, and sort of, I just love the kind of awakening effect they have for me to question the kinds of beliefs, the kinds of things I know. Another person who's really great at this is Walt Whitman. Good old Walt Whitman. Who's worked out a way of talking that he just gets right out there and says, well, you'll hear what he says. He says, I have heard what the talkers were talking, the talk of the beginning and the end, but I do not talk of the beginning or the end. There was never any more inception than there is now, nor any more youth or age than there is now, and will never be any more perfection than there is now, nor any more heaven or hell than there is now. Urge and urge and urge, always the procreant urge of the world, and here it says it, out of the dimness, opposites advance, always substance and increase, always set, always a knit of identity, always distinction, always a breed of life. To elaborate is no avail. Learned and unlearned feel that it is so. Sure is the most certain sure, plumb in the upright, well entreated, braced in the beam, stout as a horse, affectionate, haughty, electrical, I in this mystery, here we stand. Clear and sweet is my soul, and clear and sweet is all that is not my soul. Lacking one, lacks both. And the unseen is proved by the seen. So that becomes unseen and receives proof in its turn. Showing the best and dividing it from the worst, age vexes age. Knowing the perfect fitness and equanimity of things, while they discuss, I am silent and go bathe and admire myself. So he has another beautiful way of talking that includes clear and sweet is my soul, clear and sweet is all that is not my soul. He includes opposites in his speech. And I think a lot of the ecstatic poetry that Sufis and Zen masters and anyone else who's writing ecstatic poetry often includes a sense of the opposite. The opposite being there, and then just making statements like, I go bathe and admire myself. Or, you know, I look at the leaves on the tree and, you know, pick up an insect walking on it. So I thought I'll read one more poem, actually. One more. From Rumi. So it has, actually, two more poems for me. So again, it has this, this beautiful way of working with words and letting words slide away. It says, praise to the emptiness that blanks out existence. Existence, this place made from our love for that emptiness. Yet somehow comes emptiness and then this existence goes. Praise to that happening over and over. For years I tried to pull my own existence out of this emptiness. And then in one swoop, one swing of the arm, that work is over. Freed of who I was, freed of presence, freed of the dangerous fear, of hope, freed of mountainous wanting. The here and now mountain is just a tiny piece of a straw blown off into emptiness. And even these words I'm saying so much begin to lose their meaning. Existence, emptiness, mountain, straw, words and what they try to say swept out the window and down the slant of the roof. And then he has one other ecstatic poem, which is, I think, again, pointing to, in a sense, the limits of language, but again, he's using language to point to just what he's saying, just this, just the language. He says, do you think I know what I'm doing? That for one breath or a half a breath that I even belong to myself, as much as a pen knows what it's writing, or the ball can guess where it's going to bounce. Yeah. So, some more words to contemplate, and if you find yourself getting caught up in some kind of thought during the day, you could notice what it is that seems so real about that thought at that time, what it is that seems so solid, so substantial, so only one-sided. This is just something I like to practice. Is whenever one view starts to assert itself very strongly, just think of the opposite word of whatever it is you're thinking, and notice whether it's as completely separate as it seems. As that could be a practice. That's the practical application. So I'll just open this up for any comments or whatever.
In one way, I would see that as being wishy-washy. You used to know a person who would see the viewpoint on one side, and then she would turn around and talk about the opposite viewpoint, and I never knew what she said. Is there something different from what you're talking about?
In a way. In that, again, I think, and I'm not stressing as much in talking this way, which is stating lots of different viewpoints are possible, but I think language, you could think of language in several ways. One of them is as a tool. And in the way that as a tool, you want to have the right tool for the right job. And so sometimes it's necessary, and again, and this is conventionally speaking, it's necessary to have a certain opinion or a certain belief because it's appropriate for functioning in a particular context. And like, for example, you know, legalistically, or agreements even. If somebody says, you know, they'll do something, you have an agreement between the two of you, then perhaps it's appropriate at that time to both agree that you mean the same thing when you say that you'll do something. Or if you have an opinion about something that seems important for moving a process on or moving an interaction on.
You need at least put more energy into that viewpoint
at that time. At that time, right. The problem being getting so invested in that viewpoint that when it's not appropriate, you can't let it go. So, I mean, views are like, you can look at views as tools in that way. Yeah?
What you're saying, the message is that you have portrayed the simplicity it comes in stark contrast, or it starts with very much exemplified in looking at the words you see in the newspaper. You just sit back and look innocently at this whole array of words, where they're coming from, and what drift and a case in point is the stories that's been in the newspapers the past several days about earthquake preparedness. About earthquake preparedness. And having it's an area that I have a lot of expertise and insight about why we behave in certain ways in when we have great threats upon us, how we behave, and how we behave when we are overwhelmed by. And I noted in the Chronicle articles a certain drift or a certain way of talking about earthquake danger in terms of a past experience. The earthquake we had last October, the old 6th, it never ever talks about what you really can do now. The bottom line says one thing, the article says something else. The articles that were in the Tribune, taking the same period of time up until including, the articles were in the Tribune at the time of the regular earthquake. They were written with another kind of understanding of here we are now in an experience and we can do something about it. And in fact, nothing is being done about it. Yet, the two papers talking about the same subject in a totally different context. Now, this is really very interesting.
That struck you how you could be talking about an earthquake. On the one hand, kind of anchoring it in the past in some way, but not talking about the possibility, and on the other hand, talk about the possibility that one, what one could do. Just that different views.
Mm-hmm. Well, one was kind of disempowering the reader,
right.
And the other was empowering the reader.
Right. Right. And all through a use of language. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, and it's that kind of attentiveness to, you know, which view is perhaps beneficial at a particular time.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. It seems to me the case that the only way we can get at insights like that about language is through the use of more language. You know, there's kind of this circular thing that this magic circle you're in, you never break out unless we use it.
So I mean, it's like it's a tautology in a way that you keep. Right, and I think that's why I wanted to read the some of these poems to show how people break out using language. That there's a way in which people have started to speak, where they attempt to embrace the different sides, and it's that type of talking that allows for what I call greater flexibility. In terms of your own understanding, your insight, your perception, your attachment to views. And I agree, I mean, language is, in that sense, again, a tool. And it's not that you can drop it, because what are you going to do? We're talking. But it's a good tool if you can just also realize that what it's saying is it's talking about itself. It's not just talking about a world out there that we all understand. It's talking about how it talks. And that's what these people are starting to say finally. I'm just talking. So but I would agree, it can be very tautological like that, sure. Yeah.
One is about poetry. The, my experience is that these type of writers, particularly for someone like Britain, they aren't, it's not simply the subject matter and these oppositions, it's the rhythm that they use of words.
Mm-hmm.
So they do go beyond mere words, because there's a certain kind of heart training. There are a number of poets that consciously use repetition to create really almost the effect that the dervishes get, or people get who go into trances. And they intentionally set up to confound your senses, to take away your groundwork of normal understanding, so you'll have a breakthrough insight.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another way words can be used to go beyond their limits.
Right, they have like a musical quality.
It's musical in a certain kind of music, though. It's
rhythmic pattern.
Like, you know, the tintinnabulation of the bells is not a certain kind of.
Right.
But I had a question, though. I've noticed in learning foreign languages that it's a very interesting projection test to find out what you first learn, and because those are your preoccupations and you get a chance to see them in fresh, and to see how I'm interested in the power I have in creating reality, my reality, how I see people, how I treat them, how I make them treat me through words. And I wanted to know what you suggest when you talk about considering opposites in that kind of your daily life of sort of turning around a situation that you've gotten yourself into because your energy is always hooked on certain preoccupations. One I think of is I just had a big fight with my sister and I could feel what I was doing to her, and I really got in touch with I'm afraid. And I fear, just take any fearful situation if you could as an example, because I think that is a basic human experience that we all have and we're all defending ourselves from, and we're always, you know, attacking other people to get away from, and, you know, it's like fear is something we do to ourselves all the time.
Right. So how can you say the idea of
noticing
opposites?
Well, you're talking about looking for the opposite of your concept.
Well, there's real simple stuff that I think is something to notice. Is a part of built into the way I think we use language a lot is this whole notion that we can characterize or understand other people better than they themselves, that they understand themselves at times. So, for example, just having the sense sometimes when that somebody is manipulating you, and making that, like for example, making a statement like, you're manipulating me. Okay, that's one view in which I'm basically assuming I kind of know what your reality is.
And I'm the victim.
And I'm the victim of it. Right. Versus, now that's a view where I'm talking about the other person, versus turning around 180 degrees, which is the practice. How can I make a statement about myself in that situation that's the flip side of manipulation? Which would be something like, you know, I find I do things to you which later on I tend to regret having done. Which is a flip view of manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
But what a difference. What a difference. Can you imagine, you know, the difference between telling somebody you're manipulating me versus saying, you know, I realize I do things to you which later on I realize I didn't want to do. It's going to evoke a different mood in the person. So all those kinds of things like, you insulted me. I mean, there's numerous. You insulted me, flip it around to, you know, I find that I don't tend to think of myself in that way. I don't like to characterize myself as so-and-so. Or, you didn't understand me versus I don't think I've made myself as clear as I'd like to have.
But what about within yourself, if I'm feeling fear and I'm owning that?
Mm-hmm.
How
to work with the sense of fear?
Yeah, it's just your own feelings. You've already gotten beyond the
okay.
Kind of a
right.
Statement.
The major one.
Well, I mean,
yeah.
I'm just interested in the way we set up how we treat people, the kind of people we treat coming down the street.
There's different ways to work with it, especially if you're gonna work with the idea of language. One of them is that I don't think that it's just fear that's going on in those situations, but usually when you're experiencing fear or anxiety, you're usually labeling the situation or you're interpreting the situation in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you start to notice that you indeed are labeling it and notice what it is that you're saying to yourself, which may be very in the background. Again, there's a lot of conditioning in this culture to give primacy to feelings as if they were existing, once again, independently of labeling, interpretations, and so forth. So I think the first step in that, in terms of working with the fear, I mean, there's two things you do. You just notice the fear, like in the Vipassana practice, notice the fear. That's what there is. There's no implication. It doesn't mean anything. You don't have to do anything. It's fear. That's one way to work with it. The other way is to notice what it is you're saying to yourself and to start to look at the point of view you've assumed. To start to question again, and that's where we come back to, well, how is it that I backed off into this corner of just thinking whatever you might be thinking when you're experiencing fear? Start to question the view. That's another way to start to do it. But first you have to say what it is, start to articulate it.
You can
play with your physiology. I mean, notice that. And also you can play with your labels. It's really a lot of it is working with the labels and developing a more flexible ability to change the label. Which requires, monitoring it, this question, vigilance.
Flexibility,
and in your labeling, in your description. I'm just curious, when you hear somebody saying that, though, it's sort of like your intention is to not get involved in it, sounds like, or to not take it on, not to necessarily have to believe that about other people.
Right. I mean, sometimes it's an interesting fear of thought.
And is it difficult to say that to them in some way? For example, it's like just to go into it a little bit, but I mean, again, when you hear someone say those kinds of things to you, you start to think something probably, like, I don't want to hear this, but also you don't want to hear this because there's something about hearing it that is unsettling or...
I don't want to defend this person. But I don't want to hear it either.
I probably don't hear it. If you have that option. Yeah. However, Well, one of the things, I mean, it depends on what you're willing to, I mean, there's a couple ways, I think, to work with this. One of them is, when people, again, and this is a meditative practice, I think, as much meditative as sitting, which is when somebody is saying something to you, it's not necessary to agree or disagree with what they're saying. That I mean, you can take a meditative stance in the sense that you just take it in. This is just how this person is describing their perception at this moment. That's just to assume that kind of stance, that it doesn't require a response, unless they want to get something out of you, but you can just, this is just how this person is experiencing those people at this moment. That's a stance, but then that may not be enough, in the sense that the person really has some intention in bringing that information to you, which is, you know, I would like you to now side with me when we start to bitch about this person in the office, but, you know, I'd like to get a coalition going here, whatever it might be. So the other part is, I mean, in some ways you need to share with them what your point of view is at that time about that activity. And I think it often can be helpful, again, depending on what you feel like you can do at that time, to just let them know, you know, what your thought is, which it sounds like is, you know, when you talk about this person, this is, for example, a message of in such and such a way, and I realize that I don't really have a lot of information about that person because I haven't talked to them firsthand yet. And, you know, I just tend to like to suspend judgments about somebody until I've met them. It's hard for me to take in opinions about people often. You know, take them on a lot. I understand what you're saying, but it's hard for me to take them on until I actually meet them firsthand. That to me is like a statement that just lets somebody know that, you know, you're not ready to form an opinion. I don't know if that suits what you're trying to go for.
Yeah,
but you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's probably the important point, because how do you handle those initial opportunities? Well, I'm often in that kind of dynamic, referring to kind of effects and the way that you're looking at your mind. It's not an easy one to do it. You said this fact. I was working in the past more than I was. The point is this. I don't want to be part of that.
Yes.
I would prefer to think that I'm conscious enough that I don't want to be part of that.
Right,
and
sure.
I see myself fall too.
Sure. Right, so I mean, that's a very intriguing kind of position to be in the sense that someone, you know, is in some way attempting to get some kind of alignment with you, or to get some kind of, you know, positioning of some kind. So again, I think what you're saying is true.
You're being tested.
Or you're being, you know, some way you're being challenged to give a point of view at that moment.
Right.
Yeah.
But I'm also hearing it, and I'm also aware of how it influences me.
Right. Sure. And that's where the questioning comes in, I think. That's where the ability to, you know, to maintain some kind of questioning. Yeah, go ahead.
I've heard
about
situations where it's
Is that reflecting what they're saying back, kind of giving it back to them? Sure. And again, with the reflection, as you're saying, does not mean that you're agreeing or disagreeing. It's just relaying what you hear them talking about. It's neutral to some extent.
I agree with your problem. Like I was talking, so people don't hear from you that you're talking about. It's hard for me to deal with it. So a friend of mine is asking me to go walking with her this weekend, but she doesn't want to talk about the fact that her brother died of cancer. And it's really hard for me to know how to do that.
to walk with her and
I mean, not to talk about something like that. It's always something that seems to be a central preoccupation. So you need to tell not to talk about
it's like, don't think about pink elephants.
But it's not talking about so it. Yeah. I was telling you a lot of devices yet to figure out how not to do that.
So
I talked to her today about it, but we don't know. I don't know. It's impossible, you know, for me.
Well, go ahead. Yeah.
The question is, just as I've heard you do a lot of tonight, it has helped keep the idea of coming. It may be that since we have tried to define those boundaries, if you just restrain yourself from bringing up the issue and offer that kind of conscious listening to her, she may be looking for a space to explore if you'll get a with someone. And that's if you can stick with that as a technique, you may be able to talk about it in a way that you can.
But you still got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Family and my brother-in-law was this little one. Part-time, they called up early in the morning and told my father and their kids were with us. And, you know, father just said, well, you know, yeah, but we can get taken to the hospital and said, don't tell the kids and walk out. And it was like, you know, just totally opposite what I wanted to do, and here's this. Other people telling me what I would do with the kids, and I didn't know who wanted to do that. It's really
like a tough one.
It's a really uncomfortable position.
Yeah.
For him. Well, I didn't say anything to them about that. Uncomfortable. It's a totally unnatural thing. Here's what's going on. I really felt like they should know. We didn't tell them. It's a really powerful case of not expressing words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that I think what people have brought up here is that in terms of communication and languages, again, it depends a lot on who has the problem or who has the bigger problem as to who's going to listen and who's going to talk at different times. Because I might have an intention to listen to you. I actually have another poem I want to read about this. I have an intention and I want to listen to you, but I've got such a big problem, I'm not available for this thing. So, I mean, even knowing that is really helpful. And being able to state that is really helpful, because often, I do communication skills for teaching that, and just seeing sometimes the dilemmas people get into when they start to have a conversation, and really, neither side is all that willing to listen to the other side because they've got too big a problem, so they're basically just talking. And if you can just understand that much and postpone for having another time, that's very helpful. But the other part of it is I think that listening and being able to just drop one's view in the moment. Not totally, but allow it to be just like the whispering in the background or a little tapping in the background. Mm-hmm. It's another kind of practice, in a sense. It's, especially in conversation, it's a meditative practice. And there's a great poem by another poem by Chuang Tzu. Yeah.
As the one comment, because we're talking in countercultural analysis, because Gail Wright just wrote a novel called Pretending Professor. He says in Cambridge, no one listens to what people have to say, just waiting to say what they say, so they didn't report the conversation while I told them this.
Right. Right. Of course, you know, that's a lot of, that's again working on that notion that everybody's separate and discreet, and what I say has no effect on you, so therefore I can just keep talking forever, and who cares what you have to say? It won't make any difference to me since I'm the one who's talking. But, you know, you have less of a success rate, I think, ultimately influencing people to listen and do the things that you'd like them to do if you take that approach. So I think it's really a back and forth that makes for at least in communication. Because we all really are in it together. Going back to that notion that we're in this loop together. We're completely wrapped up with each other. So, when he has this is a great image for me that compelled me to this idea of just listening as well as a practice called the empty boat. If a man is crossing a river and an empty boat collides with his own skiff, even though he be a bad-tempered man, he will not become very angry. Very good point. But if he sees a man in the boat, he will shout at him to steer clear. If the shout is not heard, he will shout again and yet again and begin cursing, and all because there is somebody in the boat. Yet if the boat were empty, he would not be shouting and not be angry. If you can empty your own boat crossing the river of the world, no one will oppose you and no one will seek to harm you. That's part of our practice. Boat entry. So, by the way, I just want to say, I'm taping this so I can hear what I said. It's not to share with anybody, so this is all between us as far as I
can.
Well, I'll see what I said later when I'm listening. I was talking about that. I have to practice listening on myself sometimes.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.